everybody. I'm Sean T. Collins. I am the blogger behind BoiledLeather.com, also known as All Leather Must Be Boiled, and welcome back to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. This is our sixth episode and part two of a discussion we're having with a very special guest, but with me, as always,
is Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor of essays with inflammatory subjects on the Tower of the Hand, and occasionally drop other thoughts of mine on the internet where I see fit. And with us, indeed, is a special guest, and it is...
And I have to know my name, and my name is Amin, from the podcast of Ice and Fire.
So, okay. Hello, Amin. Today we have to discuss the topic of George R. R. Martin's sample chapter for The Winds of Winter, with which he really rallied up the fan base. The sample chapter, in case you haven't read it, can be found on George R. R. Martin's homepage, at least at the moment this podcast is recorded. So if you haven't read it until now, just stop the podcast, read it, because we will talk heavily about it, and I'm not quite sure how much you will take from the conversation if you don't know it already. So, Sean, what did you think about the sample chapter?
Well, first of all, I really enjoyed it. I think it was interesting that it addressed so directly many of the big, big questions that people had, which pertain to the Pink Letter, what was true, what wasn't true, the fate of Stannis. Although a lot of these things really aren't as settled as you'd think, because obviously this takes place far enough back in the timeline that we really don't know how dispositive it is with regards to what the content of the Pink Letter is. You know, it's not like this happened after the letter was written and it's like, oh, Stannis was alive, the whole thing was not true. You know, that's obviously not the case. You know, and as I always say when I write at length about the books themselves and sort of analyzing the text for clues and for, you know, whatever you call it, most of the things that I come up with, I don't actually come up with. I hear them and learn them from other people. But, you know, the thing that struck me the most, that I did catch on my own, because you kind of can't miss it, is that Bran, presumably, is involving himself very, very directly in Theon's fate through the Ravens. Although that raised a lot of questions that didn't occur to me right away. I was so proud of myself for being like, oh, he's in the Ravens, and they're saying Theon's name, and they're telling him to go to the tree. I'm so excited. I'm so smart. But then a lot of things I don't really understand. You know, how did... Because Asha is the person who advances the Weirwood Tree plan, telling Stannis to take Theon, rather than burning him, as an offering to R'hllor, which might alienate the Northmen, bring him to the Weirwood Tree and chop his head off, the Northern Way. The man who passes the sentence should swing the sword. But why Asha would suggest this? What put the idea in her head? What's in it for her? What she's hoping will happen? I guess maybe, you know, you could, if you want to use Occam's razor, you could say, well, she just doesn't want her brother to burn to death. Getting his head cut off is a lot more less painful. And that's true, but then he could do that any old place. He doesn't need to do it at the Weirwood Tree. And I don't really know why Asha cares whether the Northerners are loyal to Stannis or not. So there's a lot of mysteries there, even when you do get the basic contours of what's going on with regards to Bran, or I guess Bloodraven, you know, intervening through the Ravens. I don't know what the hell's going on with Asha. And so... one of the things I like about Martin's writing in general, and it's borne out in this chapter, is that each answer you get raises like a half a dozen new questions, and that it's still happening in the, you know, the penultimate book in the whole series, I think is equal parts frustrating, but it's frustrating in a fun way, and you know, so that's my general take on it.
Yeah, I had the same issues with the chapter as you just described. It just doesn't really seem to fit on the first glance. Because if Asha really was interested in Theon's manner of death, she would suggest to drown him, because after all, he's an Iron Man. But instead, she brings this Weirwood and decapitate him in front of the Weirwood. So Bran's involvement seems pretty likely, because we know already that he can see through the Weirwood. And we have to assume that he developed some kind of power, or else this would not make any sense at all. I have to say, I was pretty dumb when I read chapter because I didn't catch the Raven thing at first. I just thought, hey, why are they screaming the name and why is Theon so happy? And it came to me only later. So you have that for me. You're much smarter when you read that chapter.
Hooray! This is, I think, maybe literally the first time I've felt particularly smart in reading these books. So thank you very much, Stefan.
Yeah. Thank you enough. always obliged.
Yeah.
So
I'm sorry. Amin, what was your general read on the chapter?
Well, I thought that if this chapter had been kept in the book, it probably would be in one of my favorites. It would. And I kind of see it as Stannis' breakout chapter. I'm one of those people that didn't like Stannis earlier in the books. In The Dance with Dragons, I started to warm up with him because at least he was doing the right thing and he's finding the good fight. He's a far better alternative than the Boltons.
Yeah.
But in this chapter, he's got badass lines. He's thinking for himself. And you see what he's like away from his wife and away from Melisandre, I think. And also that it shows that he has, like other characters, he has character growth.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my big thing, Stannis' chapter. And also, yeah, like the thing with the ravens, both what they're saying, because they do see tree all over the place, right? There's something going on with that tree. But also, like, what was interesting is the logistics of the ravens and how that's done, and whether Martin's going to stay with that, because I'm not sure if he's actually thought it through, right?
Yeah,
the logistics.
Elio and Linda brought that up of Westeros fame in their sort of video podcast review of the chapter, how if a raven can only fly from one place to another and then he's stuck there, that's really not very practical. I mean, what happens? Like, then what happens to those ravens? Do they get made into raven pie? You know, by the cook at the castle they flew to? Or does someone go around with a big wagon and bring ravens back to their destination? It seems like it would make a lot more sense for ravens to have memorized one route rather than for them to know how to get to one castle, meaning a round trip. Because otherwise, I just don't see how it's practical at all. And it may be the kind of thing where, like, the wording was a little unclear, because I did notice there were a couple of actual out-and-out typos in the chapter, so it's not like it's completely ready for prime time. And some of these things could get tweaked somewhat. And I sort of do hope that's the case, because it's just a little bit hard to understand how it would work if once you let a raven go, that's it for him. Yeah, you know, that's one of those things. But I'm also glad you brought up Stannis and how he... This is sort of a breakout chapter for him because of the fact that he's away from his wife and he's away from Melisandre and can sort of be his own man. And I'm not saying that in any kind of way to reflect badly on them as women. But, you know, they're obviously sort of very dominating personalities. And he's got a strong personality, too. But for whatever reason, you know, he's really kind of... it changed himself to suit them, you know, even if only, you know, his personality seems basically the same, but what he does is a bit different. And again, Elio and Linda used the phrase that he just seems so much more alive in this chapter. And I think in addition to the fact that he's away from these very influential people in his life, he's also dealing very directly with military matters right now.
Mm.
And he's actually a masterful tactician. He was outfought at the Blackwater, obviously, because Tyrion is also a masterful tactician, and he left. You know, we things may have gone differently if he had been there to rally the troops himself. But as, you know, he lists his victories to Theon when Theon is warning him about how dangerous Ramsay Bolton is, you're like, wow, you're right. This guy is a pretty kick-ass soldier, and, you know, he beat Mance Rayder, you know, who had, you know, multiples of the number of men that he had. He beat Victarion Greyjoy, who's this great admiral. You know, he withstood this the siege of Storm's End, which, as we discussed in our previous chapter, maybe there was more going on there than met the eye, but at the same time, he did withstand that siege. And then, you know, was it Dragonstone or Storm's End? Oh, I can't even remember.
Dragonstone.
Right, he took Dragonstone. Thank you. I just got a little... My wires got a little crossed. And it's funny because as I was thinking about this, I'm currently watching the show Breaking Bad, and there's a cop character on the show, a DEA agent, and in his personal life and his personality, he's a bit of buffoonish. He's kind of a macho pig. You know, at first, especially at first, he's difficult to like. because he's just too loud, too brash, too obnoxious. But the more you see him, and the more you see him on his job in particular, you really come to appreciate him as a person because he's very good at his job. He makes these great intuitive leaps. He sees clues no one else does. He puts together the big picture. He's able to see the forest from the trees. You know, when he needs to interrogate people, he knows the right balance of being a bad cop to being a good cop. And thinking about him, I thought about Stannis and how he does seem so much more alive in this. And what's happening is he's you know, he has so many disadvantages. He's in unfamiliar territory for him. You know, his men are starving, they're freezing. He's trying to hold together this sort of coalition of people with different backgrounds and different motives and different sort of levels of military experience. And yet he seems, when you read this chapter, it's hard to keep in mind that in other chapters set in his camp, it seems like it's the Donner Party. Because he doesn't seem that way at all, and I find that so fascinating, that because he's focusing on winning this coming battle, because he's staying steps ahead of the Karstarks who are there to betray him, and he's, you know, dismissing the prowess of the Freys and the Manderlys and the Boltons who he believes are coming to get him, and he's saying these sort of cryptic things that imply that he's got this grand strategy or these tactics that he's going to put in play to win this battle. Your memory of people eating each other and being burned alive in punishment is almost like dissolved, because just in his presence, he seems so competent and so in the know and so in control of things that he comes alive and just his whole, you feel his chances are so have come alive again. You know, you feel like, yeah, he could win this thing. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah, that brings me right up to the question. Did anyone else, when you read this chapter, instantly think that he is making an Alexander Nevsky? You know, that Russian guy who fought the battle on the frozen lake in the Middle Ages? That guy is a Russian national hero, and in the 1200s or something, he fought a battle against these German knights which came to Russia to make good Christians out of them and burn and pillage and whatever. And his forces were inferior, so he attacked the Germans on a frozen lake, and the heavy armored Germans, they broke in and all drowned. And that's how he won, and he's a big and famous national hero for it in Russia still. And I just had this, when Stannis, encamped next to a frozen lake, says that he doesn't have the high ground yet, I don't know, I just thought, yeah, soon there will be several levels under the sea.
Right,
Where the dead are dancing, to quote Patchface.
Oh.
And he would be a prophet too then. And it just seems like Stannis could mayhaps go for that. Because we have already seen the Crowfoot go for the making traps, digging a hole, and then covering it, and it would just fit. It's very dirty, but a guy like Stannis, he doesn't really give something for it.
Yeah, I like that theory when I saw it in the Westeros video for a few reasons. One, in terms of the way Martin writes battles, he likes to have some sort of unexpected reversal involved, you know, with Tyrion and his chain. With Stannis coming out of nowhere during the Wildlings attack on the Wall, he likes having that sort of like, what? You know, unexpected moment that changes the tide of the battle as a writer. The other thing is that apparently he has said during, you know, book readings that this is the Battle of Ice and the coming battle at Meereen will be the Battle of Fire. So if you want to read between the lines about that word choice, it would be interesting if ice was actually involved in the resolution of the battle. And the North remembers, as we've been told by Wyman Manderly, and this would be a way for the North itself, the geography and the weather of the North, to defeat the architects of the Red Wedding, which I think is just poetic justice that might be difficult for both Stannis and George R. R. Martin to resist, you know?
Just as a quick side note about Patchface, I think he kind of is established as having some sort of visions of the future. I think he saw the Red Wedding or something like that.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting point you made there. And when it comes to battles, I didn't have very good knowledge of Russian history, but I did read about that battle on Westeros, and So I can see it after it was brought up in this, like, the chapter. But the battle that came to mind when I was reading this, which kind of interesting because people were talking about John and John Julius Caesar or whatever, connecting John to Caesar in the last book. Have you heard any chats about that?
Yeah.
Because he got stabbed and all that. Well, Caesar was in a battle, I think, with Pompey, where his men were starving and bottled in, and it was even shown on the HBO Rome, and he said that our men must win or die. The other men have other options, right? So that's basically the situation that Stannis is in right now. Mm-hmm. They have to win or they're dead. So that'll motivate them.
That's a good point.
I have to apologize a bit because I know the story about this Russian guy from a Tom Clancy novel. So I'm not exactly an expert in Russian history as well.
I know it from film class because it was an Eisenstein film.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It was mentioned in said Tom Clancy novel, and that's I just never forgot it because they discuss it, but never was into Russian history.
Oh, one other thing about Stannis, one line that I noticed, and I only noticed it because I was rereading Clash of Kings lately, the same line when Justin Macy is talking to him, and Justin Macy says, "I understand," and Stannis says, "Your understanding is not required, only your obedience." He uses that same line very early in Clash of Kings. So some parts of him are still the same, but he still is slowly developed and become a more interesting character to me.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I want to introduce my sort of kooky theory here. I don't really do a lot of theory mongering, but my question is, do you think it's possible that Stannis is the author of the Pink Letter?
Mm.
And the reason I say this is, you know, I think if you look at the Pink Letter, what it outlines in terms of the situation at Winterfell it basically lines up with information that Stannis could have and has gotten from Theon, you know, about Mance Rayner and the situation there, about who's missing, who Ramsay would want back, and how he would refer to them. I mean, I think at one point, I have it here on my blog someplace, Theon tells Stannis he wants his bride back, he wants his reek, and in the letter, it says, "I want my bride back," and then later it says, "and I want my reek." You know, it's the language is almost identical. So my theory was that Stannis maybe wrote the letter to persuade Jon to bring a force of wildlings or Night's Watchmen or whoever south from the wall to join the battle, because he obviously was unable to do this more directly. It's kind of a sketchy thing for him to do, obviously, but you know, as we just said, Stannis Baratheon is not here to make friends. You know, he's here to win. And I think what put the thought in my head, again, I have to give props to the mastersofwesteros.org, is they kind of latched on to the way that he tells Justin Massey, you know, "You may hear I'm dead, it may even be true, you know, keep working anyway." I wouldn't necessarily have read much into that beyond him just sort of making a comment about the fog of war, but, you know, that may be a useful way for him, you know, I'm sorry, playing dead may be useful for him in that way to drag that force off of the wall. And then once they get there, if there are Bolton forces around, it's not like John can walk up to Ramsay Bolton and be like, "Hey, did you write this? You know, let's work this out." You know, they're going to fight, and at that point, you know, it's better to beg forgiveness than to ask permission. You know what I mean? So that's sort of my kooky theory. I was wondering if either of you guys think I have a leg to stand on there.
Okay, so I mean, what's your take?
Okay, I would go halfway on that. I think it's definitely possible that Stannis faked his death or allowed word of that to happen, even if he's won the battle, if there's been a battle, because that can be a tactical advantage. And I don't know if he would go as far as actually sending that letter to Jon himself. I mean, he seems to like Jon. I mean, he's not a win at any cost sort of guy, or he would have killed Edric Storm right away. He still has some, you know, morals, and he's just, and he was sending who he thought was Arya up to Jon at the wall, so I don't think he would use Jon that way now. But if he had faked his death, maybe Ramsay believed him, or whoever sent the letter believed him, and ultimately he ended up causing that letter to, like, causation wise. But I don't know if he actually sent the letter himself.
Yeah, I don't know. The issue I have with the theory is that it doesn't seem to fit who Stannis is. It doesn't really seem his style to endanger the vows of someone because he would commit John to oath breaking, and he would have to punish him afterwards for it, and he would do it knowing him. So I don't see exactly why he should push John towards oath breaking when he has to have the intent of punishing him for it afterwards.
That's true. I mean, I should say that, you know, from my personal perspective, I am less stringent in terms of ascribing the term oath-breaking to what John does by announcing his intention to leave the wall and attack the supposedly oncoming Boltons, because, you know, I tend to see it in terms of it's a security issue. If Ramsay Bolton gets there, he will attack and he will kill the Night's Watch, and they have no natural means of defense there, because that's the whole purpose of why the castles were built the way they were built. They're not meant to be defensible from the south, and we've already seen just what the, you know, that small group that came over the wall to do that sort of rearguard action against Castle Black, we've seen the damage they did and how difficult it was to fend that off. So a whole army of Boltons marching up from Winterfell with God knows how many other Northmen and whatever, you know, they'd just be slaughtered, because there's obviously no reasoning with Ramsay. So I've always been fairly lenient with Jon in terms of whether or not he's forswearing his oath there. And I happen to think there are some textual clues there as well. You know, he says, if this is oath-breaking, then the crime is mine and mine alone. Whereas when he rode south from the wall in the first book with the intention of joining Rob to avenge Ned's death, you know, he was dead sure that he was damned. You know, I'm an oath-breaker. There's no doubt about it, you know. So there's something different was going on here. But you're right, Stannis probably wouldn't be that lenient, as lenient as I am on this issue. And it does seem like the kind of thing that he'd be loath to ask someone to do or to trick someone into doing. And also, I'm not sure that we've seen him do much deception, you know, as a rule. Although now I'm blanking on whether he was wise to the Mance Raider situation. I don't think he was he? Did he know that Mance was still alive?
Your question is if he knew it.
Yeah, now I can't remember.
We don't know, but I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think that he knew, but I can't really provide the evidence that he knew or not.
Right.
Just beyond that, his character seems like he probably wouldn't have allowed it.
Yeah, I mean, I just Googled and it said, you know, Melisandre kept it a secret. That doesn't necessarily mean he didn't know, but, you know, it just means Melisandre didn't tell him.
I mean, he is also capable of sleeping with Melisandre, which at least I believe is happening. So he's capable of doing things that maybe, I mean, he shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, he's not a saint. He's not a saint, but I tend to give people a little bit of a, you know, I think, you know.
Maybe he's punishing himself with, like beating himself or something to make up for those hair shirts or whatever.
Yes.
I think for the sleeping with Melisandre thing, his wedding vows were made in the faith. So they are not really eligible, and I would imagine that it was not his idea to sleep with Melisandre, but that his wife itself brought it up. So
I think she would have consented to it, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem like him to do it for fun. He does it to breed these shadows and perhaps to gain some other power, but he certainly would not fuck her for it.
He does have the Baratheon genes, perhaps not as strongly expressed.
Okay.
It's the same dreams that Renly and Robert had.
That's true. But maybe they got all of it. You know, there's one, you know, one for each sex, and then, you know, nothing for Stannis. the randiness genes have just been completely used up by his brother.
What are we looking at here?
You really have paper notes?
Oh, yeah, I like the sound of it. Chapter. Very old school.
Yeah, that's old school. Very old school.
Yeah. Well, how do we feel about the Iron Bank's involvement here?
It's just what you expected somehow, because already when we had the corresponding chapter in Feast for Crows, it was clear by everyone, and not only the reader, there were people commenting on it, that it was really one of Cersei's most dumbass moves ever. and she's really not shy about them, yeah? Mm-hmm. but this one was especially bright. And the consequences of it, you could see them from miles distance. I mean, the Iron Bank couldn't let it slide, and they expressly told Cersei that they wouldn't let it slide. So it was only expected that it would turn up with Stannis, if only to show to the Iron Throne that they wouldn't accept this behavior.
Now, I was reading on Westeros about this Iron Bank support for Braavos, and some people were arguing that it's kind of, considering the amount of money that's owed, they actually said that maybe it's not that much, and why is the Iron Bank doing this? Is it really going to be profitable to support Stannis? And perhaps, though, they were looking for somebody other than Dany, some sort of counterbalance to Dany because of the Iron Bank's distrust of Targaryens and dragons, and so maybe Stannis is the guy to go with?
Yeah, I would put it on much more mundane grounds, that they just want to get revenge of the Iron Throne and to make this statement. You have to ensure, it's their primary business model. If anyone ever gets the impression that paying back your loans is in some way optional, then the whole Iron Bank will go down. They can't let that happen. And if it means to borrow some additional millions to Stannis, and he will still lose, it doesn't really matter, because then they have made their point clear that they will wreak havoc if you don't pay your loans. And next time, people will get a little bit more, cautious.
They pretty much have to break some legs here.
I think really that's the main thing behind it. Perhaps some of them think of Dany already, but I'm not quite sure. Because if they really have the good information that we assume they have, then they will know that she's hung up in Meereen and won't come back anytime soon. And she is the mother of slaves. She is abolishing slavery, and that's always a good thing for the Braavosi. So they would at least be very ambivalent about Dany, I guess.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. They can't just say, oh, she's a Targaryen, she's no good, because she's also, you know, because she is the blood of old Valyria. She's a Targaryen and the blood of old Valyria who happens to be running around freeing slaves, which is something that they get behind generally as the heirs of free slaves. I mean, here's another case where, you know, there's a lot of potential motives for the Iron Bank, and we just don't know which one is going to bear fruit ultimately. You know, do they have this blood feud with Valyria that they're going to hew to at all costs? Or are they, you know, abolitionists, and is that their most important thing? Or are they basically, you know, like a mafia who lends money, and if you don't pay them back, they send the faceless men, you know, to blow up your restaurant or whatever. You know, the equivalent of it. Are they involved with the faceless men at all? You know, there's a lot of variables in Braavosi society that we're also not quite have a handle on. So, you know, with regards to Tycho here as the envoy from the Iron Throne, from the Iron Bank, man, there's a lot of iron. Iron Throne, Iron Islands, Iron Bank. They should all just get together on that ground, you know, just make it a little easier for people to remember what the hell we're talking about. You know, the thing that struck me once it was pointed out is his role in helping Asha ransom the freedom of her men. And, you know, one more time, I'm stealing from Elio and Linda, but they point out that the Iron Bank can't possibly be thrilled at the notion of King Euron Crozai, you know, the most notorious pirate in the world, you know, ruling the Iron Islands and potentially ruling all of Westeros. You know, so supporting Stannis, in addition to a way to get the money back that they were owed by Robert and Joffrey, is a way, and now Tommen, is a way for them to also, you know, have another bulwark against Euron if Euron gets any further with his designs on Westeros. And then at the same time, you know, on a more micro level within the Iron Islands themselves, supporting Asha, this sort of rebel niece who ran away when her uncle was elected king, you know, is a way to maybe undermine his rule, you know, in his home turf as well. I don't know that if he is privy to her ideas about using Theon's absence as a way to undo the King's Moot. You know, we don't know that yet, but it wouldn't surprise me.
The King Euron as a prime motivation for the Iron Bank is a good idea, and I definitely agree that they couldn't have any interest in the Iron Man becoming a major power operating in the Narrow Sea and beyond. But I think we have a timeline problem here, because when Euron becomes king quite unexpectedly, the Iron Bank must already have made its decision. I don't think that information travels that fast that they can know about Euron's coronation when they have sent Tycho Nahariz and discussed that stuff. It just seems too tight a schedule for them to do it on.
That's true, but here's something to consider. Don't we believe that a faceless man is responsible for the death of Balon Greyjoy on Euron's behalf? So let's say the faceless men and the Iron Bank have some sort of link. Maybe he takes this job and does it, but then reports back and is like, oh yeah, I just killed the king of the Iron Islands on behalf of his evil pirate brother who's going to wants to become king himself. You know, so information could have traveled reasonably fast.
That's an argument. Okay, I accept that premise. That could be. that's very well possible, and it's a bit twisted, and it fits the mindset of a banker quite well.
Yeah. And the assassins, since at this point they don't really seem to have any kind of moral, you know, basis for who they kill or why they kill. Even when they were an organization of aggrieved slaves, they were killing slaves with the idea that, like, oh, well, it's a mercy killing. So, you know, I have no problem believing that a faceless man could kill someone on behalf of someone else and then rat that someone else out to the Iron Bank, you know, despite having actually done the job that put them in the position that they needed to be ratted out, if that made sense.
Yeah, somehow.
Are you saying that they're like the customer service of the Iron Bank?
Yes, quite so. Yeah. We may ask you to take a brief survey at the end of this assassination. On a scale of 1 to 5, how would you rate your satisfaction with this assassination? With 1 being not satisfied at all and 5 being very satisfied.
I think if the faceless men go on as they do, then we have to withdraw their AAA rating. That's
right. Hey, just a complete side note, but just because we're talking about banks.
Yeah.
I mean, Littlefinger and all his embezzling and things like that, doesn't that seem a lot like the financial crisis sort of stuff? It's all paper money, basically, in the King's Landing.
Yep.
Yeah, Littlefinger certainly powers some of it into the economy, that's for sure.
I wonder if the Iron Bank is wise to that guy. I feel like they may be one of the only institutions in the entire series that stands a reasonable chance of having sussed out that he's up to no good. I have no basis for that, but it just seems like they're masters of money and so is he, and you would think that maybe they would get wise to him at some point, but
I think he said that they weren't, he wasn't, he was going to have to borrow from the Lannisters because he couldn't get money from other places.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he'd reached his credit limit.
That's possible, of course.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I agree with you, Stefan, that, yeah, it's probably the Iron Bank is willing to even take a loss here if the money-wise, hiring all these sellswords, just to make the point, because this is only one of the places they have a loan to. They have far larger loans than this, and so this is just a business policy sort of thing, what they're doing with Stannis.
I think that's true. But I think there's also a blend of business and personal with them, because there needs to be, you know, as Stefan said, if you learn that there's no consequences to defaulting on your loan from the Iron Bank, you know, then that puts their money in jeopardy all over the world. But if you learn that if you don't pay your loan back, they overthrow you, you know, that's a pretty big deal. That's a message worth sending. Even though I think Stannis seems like a long shot to me, you know, I don't know if there's more plausible candidates they could have aligned themselves with, but
in Westeros, no.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. In Westeros, no. Maybe there are, but, you know, like, you know, maybe they could have got behind. Yeah, I just don't know. It just doesn't seem like, you know, if they were wise to Aegon Targaryen, so in quote-unquote Aegon Targaryen, would they have supported him?
Perhaps. I mean, they could have made up this very wise strategy and bought some better ships and landing gear for Euron Crow's Eye, but then, I don't know. it doesn't seem like the best course to go, so Stannis is the safer bet.
Yeah.
So going back to the chapter, I have also a little side note, really, is the manner in which Theon is held by Stannis. I found it really, really brutal, because he hangs him on the wall and lets him suffer there, really day and night. I don't know, he's there for quite a long time when we read the chapter. So that seems pretty harsh, even for Stannis.
That's true. I mean, you know, because I guess you have to consider that Theon isn't a POV character for Stannis. Theon is just a child killer, you know, and three-time turncloak or whatever. So fuck that guy if you're Stannis, you know. You're right, though. You know, it's funny. You know, once I had that image in mind, I just flashed back to so many, like, Far Side comics, and You Can't Do That on Television, which is a show that aired on the Children's Network over here that had, like, this dungeon scene where, like, these kids would be chained up in a dungeon. So it was just hard for me to, like, appreciate how brutal it was, because the image is associated with, like, cheesy broad comedy about dungeons. So, but you're right. I mean, that was a really, really nasty way of treating Theon, you know, and which I guess is a way, you know, a bit of a character insight for Stannis as well.
Well, the Northmen wanted him dead, so I mean, keeping him alive, I guess that's kind of the least he's suffering sort of thing.
Right,
to keep the Northmen happy.
That's true. Yeah, you couldn't just have him, you couldn't treat him you couldn't even treat him like the Tullys treated Jaime Lannister.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't going to have it at all. You know, the days of treating him with, like, deference because he's a lord's son, you know, that's obviously... He threw that away when, as far as they all know, he killed Bran and Rickon, so.
Yeah, the North remembers.
Yep, bingo.
Yeah, that line is really one that gives you the shivers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm trying to think of this, you know, I guess we haven't even really talked about that this is a Theon chapter, you know? We've just talked about it in terms of what it tells us about Stannis and other people in it, because it's a chapter about Stannis. You know, more than it's about Theon. But, you know, in terms of Theon's journey from Theon to Reek and back to Theon, I mean, do you guys have any strong feelings about what we learned about him and his current state of mind here?
I mean, he is going nuts.
Yeah.
And pretty much so. Theon is fucked up by what Ramsay did to him. He is definitely not the guy he was, and he never will be again. He has been hit very hard, mentally, and... The character he is now is a shell, mostly, for paranoia, thoughts, for psychosis of all different kinds. And we don't know where the character will ultimately end up, and if he will end up anywhere or just die. It is really possible that they go through with the execution or something like that. But I don't know. At the moment, Theon is like Tyrion was most of Dance with Dragons. He is a character in transit. He is waiting for, or preparing for, the next big character arc, for the next big development of character. He is really nowhere at all. He is a leaf in the wind. He doesn't care if he dies. It was the same with Tyrion. He wasn't hit so hard.
Oh, yeah.
But the general... the general condition the character is in, it is the same. So we will have to see whether Theon gets a chance for redemption, or whether he will go down the path of being just Reek in a more or less conscious mindset.
Yeah, it so much depends on what happens when he gets to that tree, and what Bran or Bloodraven have in mind for him when they get there. You know, I can't for the life of me figure out what the plan could be.
No, not really.
You know, or what the importance of that is. You know.
I mean, I
wonder if Theon is weak enough at this point for Bran to skin change into. You know, because he has this sort of... His personality has been so devastated.
Yeah, Bran could surely slip into him, but then what? What would happen?
Right, then what happens, exactly?
He should then go into Stannis. That could help. I think that would be most difficult, and we know from Bran's warging into Hodor that the one being warged, I don't know how you pronounce it, is conscious. You know what happens to you when someone does that. And Bran has to leave Stannis' body or whoever he walks in ultimately. So I don't see what that would accomplish.
Yeah. And I think there's also some question as to whether the rules of skin changing that Varamyr Sixskins relates to us in his POV chapter at the beginning of A Dance with Dragons with regards to skin changing into other human beings. We don't know if Bloodraven... I don't think we know that if Bloodraven ascribes to those rules or if the Children of the Forest ascribe to those rules or not. Bran has obviously kept it a secret to the extent that one can keep anything a secret from these people. I'm a little doubtful about that. But, you know, is this something that Bran would feel comfortable, like, doing on his own? I mean, you know, now it's just we're in the realm of pure conjecture at this point. But I do, you know, I just fail to see, you know, what else he could be up to. I just have a hard time figuring, like, what difference does it make whether he's at this tree or not.
Well, from the theories I've read, apparently the tree might give Bran more power to communicate, as we were saying, but, like, is he going to appear in the tree? How is he going to communicate is the question.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's a way to get Stannis to the tree and Theon is incidental.
Yeah.
Because we did learn from the last book that he could make himself heard. He said Theon audibly, and Theon heard it. So maybe that's... Maybe you're right. Maybe it's not Theon he wants to get to the tree, it's Stannis.
Yeah.
And when Stannis gets to the tree, then he can talk to Stannis or something.
Well, another idea that people were tossing around, that maybe Theon will be executed and the blood sacrifice will also help the communication.
Hmm.
Oh, should be pretty callous.
Yeah. Although, you know, Stefan and I discussed the religions of Westeros the other day, the other week in a previous episode, and he brought up the fact that blood sacrifice seems to play very little, if any, a role in the magic of the children or the dreamers or whatever you want to call them, or the old gods and the green seers and skin changers and stuff. There doesn't really seem to be that connection between bloodshed and supernatural ability that you see with Miri Mazdur or with Melisandre.
Unless you believe that Jojen's been chopped up into small pieces and Bran's been eating him.
Oh man, the Jojen Doomsday theory. I don't know about that. Yeah, maybe that's why Rickon's in Skagos, because over there they eat people all the time, and so now he's like Gandalf. He's so charged up with blood magic by eating people for a few months that he's unstoppable.
Yeah, right.
Okay. But we do know the North had blood sacrifices before.
Right? Yeah, definitely. That's one of the things that crept me out, let me creep out really the most about Dance with Dragons. The whole theme of how savage the North really is.
Mm-hmm,
and blood sacrifices, they are only the tip of the iceberg here. The behavior of the mountain clans is also very gross.
Well, even like the way Theon is tied up, is like, wasn't that already like set up there? That was the dungeon was already set up that way, and they just tied him up to that thing?
Yeah, that's not something they invented. Yeah, they're certainly rough customers. I mean, the first thing we really see Eddard Stark do is execute a guy for being here. So.
and I mean, he's the nice guy.
Right, yeah, he's the nice one, exactly. He's the good guy, and that's the first thing we see him do is chop a dude's head off. So,
The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Exactly right, yeah.
If he's the good
numbers.
Yeah. I'm getting cold just as you say it.
Yeah, now it sounds like you ever danced with the devil in the pale moonlight. It sounds evil now.
I'm glad I haven't heard a Bolton say it yet.
Oh, yeah, that would give you the creeps.
Oh, yeah. It just holds so much promise. This is really, really bad.
So have we exhausted this chapter? What's left? Anything?
Well, one thing I'm looking at is when the king is talking about Bolton coming out and attacking him, and he says that's like a big mistake. And in a way it is, because Stannis would have been dead anyways, but it's also Bolton is a master of leading off troops that he doesn't like. He's done that before, so could this just be another move where he's just getting rid of the Freys and the Manderlys?
Yeah, that's entirely possible. It makes a certain amount of sense, too, and he has sent Ramsay out there, so should Ramsay die by chance, it would fit him, too, I suppose. Then he would just whelp out to some additional trials and get on with it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not exactly emotionally attached to his bastard son.
No, he was going to kill the bastard son until it became politically expedient for him not to.
Yeah, definitely.
When he, you know, his intention, if he hadn't had his falling out with the Starks, his intention once he returned to the North was to execute Ramsay. And surely Ramsey knows that. I mean, it's not a happy relationship.
No, not at all.
He also has the letters that the maester has, the maester he's got captured. So do you think he sent one of those letters to Winterfell?
Didn't they even say that one of the letters was sent?
Well, that's the one that had the map. The map was sent before Stannis found out about it.
Right. Yeah, I assume they're gonna send false information to Winterfell and like, hey, everything's fine here. Come on out.
Yeah, that's a good point. Definitely. I mean, they would be stupid if they didn't.
I'm glad you brought up the maesters again because, you know, since we now have all these theories about what the maesters are up to, I read that passage where he interrogates the maester very closely, and you know, I don't really see any more information coming forth beyond, oh, well, the maester is loyal to the lord he answers to. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh, you know, here's a maester who's directly involved in, like, this intrigue, this political intrigue, you know, he's helping to deceive this potential king on behalf of his lord. Like, maybe now we'll get a hint of, you know, some broader maester conspiracy. But nope, it just seems like he was just following orders, because that's what they're trained to do.
Well, there's maesters and there's maesters. So this guy's just a...
Yes, that's very true. That's very true. I wonder, you know, when you think about it right there, it's got to be kind of difficult to... It would be difficult, if not impossible, to maintain some broad, overarching conspiracy between all of these people who you train simply to work for all these lords who potentially hate each other, you know? Like, you're sending maesters all over the Seven Kingdoms to work for rival houses and trusting them not to reveal any of these secrets or whatever... And unless they're feeding it all back to some central clearinghouse, it seems like it would be, you know, right here you have a case where a maester is defying one lord on behalf of his own lord. It's just tough to conceive of a way where they're, you know, secretly, you know, they're so depend. You know, basically what I'm saying is his life depends on not deceiving Stannis, and he does it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what his immediate supervisor lord wants him to do. So it just becomes then tough for me to imagine that... You know, they're while he's loyal to this lord, so loyal to this lord that he's willing to defy Stannis, he's also actually been trained to maintain the secret agenda the whole time too. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't say like I know what you mean, but I wouldn't say that he would have to know the secret agenda. It could be that you follow your lord unless the Citadel calls.
Right.
It tells you to do something. You don't even need to know what. You just do it.
Yeah.
That if they were trained that way, but they are people, and they do become attached to the different families. Like look what Lewin was doing. He was basically like raising the Stark kids and helping with strategy. Pycelle became a toady of the Lannisters. Like, they become attached to the families they're involved with.
Yeah, Larson was going to assassinate Melisandre to defend Stannis and his daughter.
So, do we have any point left?
Just one last question. Justin Macy and Asha Greyjoy. Is that going to work?
I mean, it's the romantic story of the century, of course. but I don't know. I mean, not really, no.
Yeah, I don't see that panning out for old Justin. Stannis, like, could not stop insulting the guy. He's counting on him to pull off this, like, super sensitive mission to, like, their financial backer, and if he dies, this is the guy he's counting on to, like, advance the cause of his daughter for the Iron Throne, his child, and despite all that, like, he just could not stop mocking the guy to his face. I don't really see Justin as, like, a serious contender for Asha Greyjoy, therefore, you know?
That is the point of Stannis knowing the ability of his men, because even though he's making fun of them, he knows that this is the right guy to send compared to some of his other guys. To be able to treat.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah, and it's just another case of his contempt for anyone who has any social skill whatsoever, you know? Like, he hates the guy because the guy talks in a way that other people want to listen to. You know what I mean? That's so Stannis.
I mean, Justin, he seems like a very decent guy, but Asha is not exactly in decent guys.
Right. That's a good point. Although Theon... didn't Theon think that Sir Justin was going to assassinate the guy to whom Asha had been betrothed? So Theon's a little doubtful about Justin's decency.
Although, yeah, that's true.
Not that I think Theon Greyjoy is a great judge of character.
So he'll just be Asha's salt boy.
Is soft boy a thing? It should be. If it's not, it ought to be.
Well, there's more than Asha that like Asha's not a complete anomaly. I mean, there's other. I mean, there's Hagen's daughter. So there's other women that apparently can fight too from the Iron Isles.
Yeah. So. Surely they do something once they're they've been away from home a while. Asha, I find it so funny that Asha is like this weird sex symbol. She's like a horrible person.
Why a horrible person?
Yeah. Why?
Well, she just goes around killing people and has, like, no compunction about it whatsoever. She's not as bad as a lot of the people in her family, because they're, like, super-duper awful.
Yeah, but she normally only kills people who are armed and fighting her, too.
Yeah.
I think Asha is not exactly the guy who would kill innocents or slaughter captives or something like that. She fights because she likes fighting, but she's not exactly like many other people, like Victarion. I can't imagine her throwing tied up women overboard.
No, that's true.
For that matter.
Yeah.
So she's an ironborn, and that's just how she is. It's like scolding Ned for executing that guy when he could have sentenced him for a lifelong sentence, you know. That's a bit what she is, and it is not unusual in Westeros at all.
Yeah, I guess this is my cultural bias against Vikings showing.
Yeah, true. I mean, I feel with you there. you are talking to the number one Ironborn hater, but I think Asha is the best of the lot.
Yeah, but the treatment of the Glovers, for example, right? Like, she treats Lady Glover pretty well.
Yeah, she has sense. She has a broader vision of how to conduct politics. She has a vision for her people, for the future, and it is a future in which they don't have to burn, pillage, and rape anymore. So I'm happy to root for Asha.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I remember, when I was reading that passage about how Lady Glover had a baby who wasn't thriving because of the journey over the ocean. And wasn't eating. Like, I had just had my baby, and I, like, found that really hard to deal with, and the fact that Asha actually kind of gave a shit about that, I was like, okay, good for you, Asha, not just killing babies, especially in these books, you take it where you can get it.
She's no worse than most of the other players of the game, or families here, so.
Yeah, right, she's no saint, that's for sure, but she's also not the devil.
Yeah, Asha Greyjoy, does not slaughter babies indiscriminately. Like, it may not be much of a campaign slogan, but for a Song of
Life of babies. Well, she does think about having an abortion, abortion / contraception. So,
right.
She thinks of having to take the moon teeth. So.
Well, she's a liberated woman.
Yeah.
She's for Planned Parenthood.
Right.
Yeah.
No defunding it from her.
So if we don't have any points left, I would go to the last small subject we want to encounter today. So are there any last points?
No.
Two tiny points that I'll mention that I just circled.
Okay.
One, because it's just out of interest, is just very, very at the start of the chapter, there's the word fever dream.
Yeah.
And I've been paying attention to that in the books. It comes a few times in the books. Martin likes that word. I mean, he even has a book named Fever Dream.
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind. I don't know if I'll mean anything, but it might. The other thing is Precious Ned. More than one person does that. So the people that don't like Ned like using that term. Precious Ned.
Yeah, Martin has some phrases he likes to repeat. I also always make note of a construction he uses is shivering violently. Characters who are really cold are always shivering violently. It creates a really good mental image, but I've stumbled over it several times now, and it's among his favorites.
Yeah, useless as nipples on a breastplate.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. I think you watch too much Batman and Robin.
And I'm obviously a big boiled leather fan, so. Fellas, I actually may sign off here. I had probably better get back to my family at this point. So I don't know if you want to reconvene another time for the board game discussion, or if you want to just continue without me.
We could simply put that for the next time. If we can find a date where Amin has time also, we could just repeat format.
Sounds good to me.
To me too.
Yeah. All right, cool.
Yeah.
Okay, then let's do it.